Last time, we ended up with the last part of Revelation 7, and we learned that John saw in this vision what was going to be the final events on this earth's history. It was a summary of what was going to happen when after the 144,000 were sealed. And we saw that for the righteous, it's going to be a day of deliverance. For the wicked, it's going to be a day of destruction. So this lesson is going to deal with uncovering the meaning of the seven trumpets. And it requires first that we review the history of the Christian church that we studied under the seven churches and the seven seals. Just quickly, we're going to go through that so that we can remind ourselves, you know, refresh our minds about what was going on in the church, because it was what was going on in the church that's the reason why we have the trumpets. But first, we're going to look at what the trumpets mean in the Old Testament, because then that way we can understand why the symbolism of the trumpet was used. So this lesson is kind of going to be broken down into four units: examination of the Old Testament types, brief review of the prophecy so far in Revelation, and then an overview of the history of Rome, and that's where I got stuck having to with my whittle stick. And then at the end, we'll apply all these things. So, quickly, remember that the white horse of the seal, the first seal, related to the Ephesus church. The time frame was 34 or 31 AD, whichever you want to take it from the crucifixion. 34 was the stoning of Stephen, to AD 100. Which these are about dates, you know, I mean, that you can't have an absolute starting date because you don't have an absolute thing that happened to put a pinpoint to it. So we know that John died about AD 100, a little after AD 100, and it was after he died that things really got rolling in a wicked way within the church. Then the red horse symbolized the church under persecution, Roman persecution, pagan Roman persecution. And that lasted until 313, when Constantine passed a law and said, no, we're not going to persecute Christians anymore. We're going to accept the Christians, and I'm going to become a Christian. Then the black horse correlates to the Pergamos church, and that was a church of apostasy. It was under the Pergamos church that these pagan ideas began to be brought in. Instead of being shunned and said, no, that's paganism, we don't want it, they said, oh, well, if it'll make the pagans come and join the church, what does it matter if we do these things? So they allowed things to come into the church that should never have been there. So that was, Pergamos means marriage, and it was during this marriage of the church that paganism was exalted. Remember that? Then that church ended, and we do have a pretty absolute date for that, 538 AD, because it was at that time that the last of the tribes that were in opposition, political opposition, to papal Rome, the rise of papal Rome, was done away with. So 538 is a pretty solid date. We know what happened in that year. So the beginning of 538 then is the beginning of the Thyatira church, which is the pale horse seal. And we know that from then on, for 1260 years, the church had control of everything. They had control of politics, they had control of religion, and pale symbolizes that the church was about to die, because the Bible was not available to anybody, and they were fed bad spiritual food, so they were starving themselves to death. They taught for doctrine, the teachings of men, instead of opening their Bibles and studying their Bibles, like we're doing here. During this time, they were doing what Christ himself had condemned. He said, at his time, he was speaking to the Jewish people, of course, but they were teaching their own doctrines. They were perverting the gospel. They were perverting the Ten Commandments and making them hard, especially the Sabbath commandment. There were 663 laws that were concerned the Sabbath commandment. They made the Sabbath a burden to keep. So Christ condemned them, and he said, this people, the Jews, honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. Howbeit in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. Colossians, we find a similar thing where Paul wrote, beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit after the tradition of men and the rudiments of the world, and not after Christ. So what we're trying to do here is follow Christ not the traditions of men. We're trying to see what the Bible has to say and what history has to say in our understanding of Revelation. We don't want to follow the ideas of men. So the fifth seal was the Church of the Reformation, correlates to Sardis, the Church of Sardis. That church started out okay. They were on fire when they finally realized the prophecies pointed out that the papacy was the Antichrist. But when those first reformers died, the Reformation kind of died with it because they again adopted the doctrines of men and they developed creeds. So we have the creed of the Lutheran Church and the creed of the Presbyterian Church and the creed of this church. They didn't follow the Bible. They made man-made creeds and then that's what they lived on. The sixth seal was a time of the end. And we say that because it led to 1798, which was the end of the prophecy, time prophecy, 1260-year prophecy, for the papacy to rule in its power. And because it led to 1844, which was the end of Daniel's 2300-day prophecy. So this was the church of the end. During this time, there was a lot of reformatory work that was taking place in the churches. This was the time of Wesley and Whitfield. They developed a lot of Bible societies. People became more dependent on the Bible and Bible truth. The seventh seal correlates to the cleansing of the sanctuary. It is the time of the Laodicean church, and it's the time of the second coming. It's the time under which we live. It's now that Bible truth will be proclaimed in purity. It's now that people are going to finally understand the everlasting covenant that will prepare them for the second coming. It's now that the righteousness of Christ is finally going to be proclaimed as it was at the day of Pentecost. So the vision that we see here in the trumpets repeats the time frame and the history of the seven churches and the seven seals. So we need to remember what was going on during that time. But the prophecy now focuses on the political world. Wars and that sort of thing, political change within the government of Rome. And it declares impending judgments against the church because the church is in apostasy. Now let's look at some of the Old Testament types. And when I did this study, I thought this was really fascinating to go back and look at the Old Testament types in the Old Testament and see when trumpets were used. So we're going to quickly read through these verses here. They're from various places in the Old Testament. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, in the first day of the month, shall ye have a Sabbath, a memorial blowing of the trumpets, a holy convocation. Now, this seventh month was the beginning of the end of their year. The year started with Passover, and it went to the Day of Atonement. The first day of the month, they blew the seventh trumpet all year long from Passover until the seventh month. At the beginning of every month, they blew a trumpet. The trumpet was to remind the people, judgment's coming. Keep yourselves ready. So the first of the month, and the first of the month was not like the first, of March and the first of May, or it was the first of the month according to the new moon. When the new moon, not the full moon, they calculated their months and their time according to the new moon. When the new moon came, they blew a trumpet. And the warning was, judgment's coming. The Day of Atonement is coming. When the last month came, they blew a trumpet and they said, judgment's coming in 10 days. Because the Day of Atonement followed 10 days after the blowing of that seventh trumpet. On the Day of Atonement, they also blew a trumpet. Thou shalt number seven Sabbaths of years unto thee, seven times 7 years, and the space of the seven Sabbaths of years shall be unto thee 49 years. Then thou shalt cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the seventh month in the Day of Atonement. You shall make the trumpet sound throughout your land. Now this trumpet was only blown every 49 years. On the Day of Jubilee. The Day of Jubilee fell on the Day of Atonement. And that's significant for our end time understanding too. Because when we get to the end of time, which is running upon us very quickly. When that final day of atonement is, then the earth has seen its cleansing, there'll be a day of Jubilee for us too, if you understand what the Jubilee is all about. Because the Jubilee was the setting free of slaves. Land that had been held in lien was set free and turned back to the owner. Anybody who had been in bondage for any reason was turned loose. That's what the Jubilee was all about. It only happened every 49 years. So this was a trumpet that the people looked forward to, because they knew when this trumpet happened every 49 years, no matter what had happened to them, if they had sold themselves into slavery because of some debt, they were set free. If they had put a debt on their property came back. You know, that would be great if your mortgage was paid off on the 49th year, right? So anyway, that's what the Day of Jubilee is about. The next trumpet was an alarm. And if you go to war in your land against the enemy that oppresseth you, then ye shall blow an alarm with the trumpets, and ye shall be remembered before the Lord your God, and ye shall be saved from your enemies. This trumpet was a call to war. So we have so far in the trumpets the call to the Day of Atonement, the announcement of the Day of Atonement, because they blew a trumpet on the Day of Atonement, the announcing of the Day of Jubilee, which happened on the Day of Atonement every 49 years. Then we see that the trumpets were used to announce war. This is an actual usage of trumpets in war. And ye shall compass the city, all ye men of war, and go round about the city once. Thus shalt thou do 6 days. And 7 priests shall bear before the ark 7 trumpets of ram's horns. And the 7th day ye shall compass the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. And it shall come to pass that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when ye hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city shall fall down flat. This is the fall of Jericho. Trumpets were also used when Gideon won over the Midianites. You remember the story of the trumpets and the pitchers, right? When they blew the trumpets, the Midianites were scared. They jumped up in the middle of the night. They went about and they killed themselves. So both of these are days of deliverance. And they were delivered through the power of God. And the men did what they were told to do in marching or encompassing the Midianite camp. But it was God that delivered them. This is another use of the trumpets. And Zadok, the priest, took an horn of oil out of the tabernacle and anointed Solomon. And they blew the trumpet. And all the people said, God save King Solomon. And when Joab heard the sound of the trumpet, he said, wherefore is this noise of the city being in an uproar? And Jonathan answered and said unto Adonijah, verily our Lord King David hath made Solomon king. So this use of the trumpet was the announcement of a king being coronated. Now we move into a time when trumpets are used in a prophetic sort of way. This is Isaiah 27, verse 13. And it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which were ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and the outcasts of the land of Egypt, and shall worship the Lord in the holy mountain at Jerusalem. Now, this verse here in Isaiah 27, verse 13, is very much identical, not word for word, but the same ideas are here, that we read a couple of weeks ago in Isaiah 11, chapter 11, verse 11 and 12. We said at that time that there was a literal fulfillment of this when Israel did come back from Babylonian captivity. When there were people, Jews, who had been scattered to Assyria and scattered to Egypt, and they were brought back when they heard that Israel had come back to the land of Israel and were working to reestablish the nation. They did come back from these places. But there's keys here that tell us that this prophecy in Isaiah is pointing forward to an end time. The keys are the words, the phrase, in that day, and the great trumpet. These emphasize end time events. In that day, in prophecy, refers to the second coming of Christ. And you see similar things. We're going to look at another verse here. In that great trumpet that shall be blown refers to the same thing that Paul talked about in 1 Corinthians 15:52, when he said, that trumpet shall sound and the dead shall rise. And he also used the phrase, in 1 Thessalonians 4:16 when he said, "And Christ shall come, Michael shall come, with a great shout, and a trumpet shall sound, and the dead in Christ shall rise first." It's that same trumpet that's being talked about. This new Jerusalem, the Holy Mount of Jerusalem, is projected forward to that new Jerusalem. It's not talking about the city of Jerusalem now and the rebuilding of a temple over there now and, you know, reclaiming the Holy Mount where the mosque sits. It's not talking about that. It's talking about the Holy Jerusalem that we're going to read about when we get to chapter 21 of Revelation. Now, here's another, quote, prophetic use of the words trumpet that supports what I just said. You know, line upon line, precept upon precept, the Bible explains itself. This one says, "Blow ye the trumpet in Zion, and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord cometh, for it is nigh at hand. Blow the trumpet in Zion, sanctify a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the people, sanctify the congregation." Joel here brings out three main points that support what we just said about the prophecy in Isaiah. The first is he uses the same phrase, "day of the Lord," which is identical to "in that day." When you read it in prophecy, "day of the Lord," "in that day," refers to the end time events. Joel also mentions Zion here and my holy mountain. So that supports what we said from Isaiah, that that holy mountain and Zion is a future prophecy pointing towards the reestablishment of Israel. The last section here, "sanctify a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the people, sanctify the congregation," all point to an end time event with the cleansing of the sanctuary, because these were the things that were done on the Day of Atonement. You brought the congregation together. They had a fast for that day. It was a very solemn assembly, and the congregation was sanctified on that day because all sin was done away with. So we see that the people are called here in this verse, end time prophecy, to sanctify themselves and to be made holy through a belief, a faith in the covenant promise of God to deliver from sin. In summary of the points that we've seen here about how the trumpets are used, we see that they were used to announce the coming of the Day of Atonement. They declared the Day of Jubilee, which was a day of freedom. They were a call to remember the commandments of God. I took that slide out. That's one of them that I sliced. But when they got to Sinai, there was trumpets blown to call them to hearing of the Ten Commandments. Yeah, to come to the mountain, and the Lord spoke the Ten Commandments, and there was trumpets blown. So that's where this one comes from. Trumpets were used to declare war, to declare the final day of judgment of the world and prophecy, and to proclaim the new king's coronation. Now, with this summary, can you see where we might be going, talking about the seven trumpets in Revelation? Is this giving you any kind of clues about what the trumpets are going to be about? So what we're going to find in these points of the trumpets from the Old Testament is that the typology is used when we get to Revelation, talking about the trumpets. But the primary use of the trumpets in the Old Testament was to warn of coming judgment, whether it was a judgment of war or the judgment of the Day of Atonement. We saw that on the annual Day of Atonement, that was the day of cleansing the people and cleansing the camp of all vestige of sin. If anybody chose not to participate, if they stayed in their rebellion and they said, "I'm good, I don't need any of this," you know, whatever, and I don't know whether there was anybody that chose to act that way or not, but you can imagine that there might have been. If they were, they were cast out of the camp. They were considered heretics in rebellion, and they were cast out of the camp. So it's a pretty serious day. What we see here from this Old Testament use of the trumpets is that God doesn't do anything without warning his people. God isn't going to sneak up on you and condemn you, and you say, "But you didn't tell me, Lord." No, he's told you, and he will tell you again and again, trying to get your attention. And that's what we see in these trumpets. So in the eight verses that we're going to be looking at this morning, chapter 8, verse 8, about verse 6 to 13, just these eight verses, Jesus gives John a prophecy that covers rapid fire, the first four trumpets. It's just boom, 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 and we're right through them. And what we see is that these trumpets were sent because at the time the trumpets start, we relate that to the Pergamos church and the Thyatira church because that's when the trumpets start. They don't start in AD 31 or AD 100. They don't start under the church of Ephesus and Smyrna. They don't start until we get to Pergamos. And that's key to understanding the trumpets because the trumpets then should be understood as God's judgment on a church that was apostatizing. He was trying to warn them and to bring them back in line. It was corrective. So the trumpets in the Bible symbolize war, announce judgment against enemies, and call God's people to prepare spiritually for his final day of reckoning. And I know there's only three. Now I had six and now I've whittled it down to three. So the starting date for the first trumpet is about 410 AD. Here's the dates for the Pergamos church, 313 to 538. So it was during this time that we see all this turmoil and the establishment of doctrines of men that was taking place. Acceptance of paganism was brought into the church. Sunday worship was brought into the church during this time so that it eclipsed Sabbath keeping. God didn't do away with Sabbath keeping. Christ didn't do away with Sabbath keeping. The church did away with Sabbath keeping. And it happened during this time period. It didn't happen at the time of Christ. So we see under the Pergamos church, we have a compromise with paganism, this great falling away that Paul talked about in 2 Thessalonians 2, and we've studied that in depth already. And this Gnostic philosophy about the Godhead was exalted, and traditions replaced the Bible. Satan couldn't do anything with the church working from the outside through pagan Rome. He battered at the church, persecuted the people. During the Smyrna church, there was so much compromise, so much persecution, that there was scarcely any Christian that had a whole body. They had arms chopped off, they had legs chopped off, eyes poked out, because they were so persecuted. They crucified them. They did anything they could to try to deter them from accepting the Christian faith. This is what pagan Rome did to Christians. In 313, that all stopped because Constantine says, we're not going to have this. I'm not going to run my government that way. So he quit persecuting Christians. Well, he quit persecuting Christians, but it opened the door for paganism to come in. The Thyatira church was a time period under which paganism became firmly established within the church, and the papacy was established. Doctrines that were contrary to the Bible were developed, and persecution of God's people began by the church. Before, it was pagan Rome that was persecuting. Now, it was the church that persecuted anybody who wouldn't believe like they did. And that continued up to the time of reformers. Remember, we studied that when we studied the churches, that during this time, people were burned at the stake if you didn't believe like the church demanded that you believe and accept their doctrines. With all this establishment of various points, let's go now and read the text from the scripture. And then we'll go on to the next slide. We want to start reading Revelation chapter 8, verse 6. And the seven angels which had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood. And they were cast upon the earth, and a third part of the trees burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. And the second angel sounded, and as it were a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and a third part of the sea became blood. And a third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and a third part of the ships were destroyed. And a third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. And the name of the star was called Wormwood. And the third part of the waters became wormwood, and many men died of the waters, because they were made bitter. And the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars. So as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. And I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound. Like I said earlier, Christ gave this vision to John and he covered an awful lot of history. A lot of things happened in just these 8 verses. And that's where I got bogged down in how much to bring to the lesson today. There are parallels here, and if you're familiar with the prophecies of the chapter 16 and the plagues that are going to fall, there's parallels. In the plagues and here, symbology is used of hail, fire, blood, sea and rivers being affected. The sea becomes blood. Sea creatures died. There are three parts talked about here. There are three parts talked about in chapter 16. And darkness in both prophecies. That's just an aside. I just want to put it in your mind that there's parallels. Because, you know, last week we talked so much about the parallels. But all this is pointing to similar symbols between these wars and the final war between Christ and Satan. So let's look at the trumpets. The first four trumpets concern the overthrow of the western half of the old Roman Empire. Not the eastern half, just the western half. The third part relates to the division of the Roman Empire after Constantine the Great died. When he died in AD 337, his three sons divided up the Roman Empire among themselves. One of them took Turkey and the Balkans, what we call now the Balkan states, you know where that is, where we've had all the wars with Croatia and all that. That's the Balkan states. He took part of that and ruled from Constantinople. The second son took the eastern sector, which was the Mediterranean area where Syria and Antioch and Persia, and he took that part, and Egypt. The third son took Italy and all the islands and northern Africa. That was his part. So they split it up and they co-ruled, but each kind of ruled their own sector, but that's how they split the area up. The first trumpet now is generally understood by most commentators to be Alaric of the Goths. In 395, the emperor at that time in Rome died, and it left Italy weak. And the Goths began to push south into Italy. They had never been in Italy. They had been on the other side of the mountains in Switzerland. And they had been up in Germany, and they had been over into the Romania, you know, what we have now is Romania and Hungary and whatnot. That's where they lived. They didn't come over the mountains until this time. So the first trumpet is Alaric the Goth. And in AD 410, he actually conquered the city of Rome. The second trumpet is Genseric and the Vandals. Genseric operated from 440 to 455. In 455, he conquered the city of Rome. The third trumpet is Attila and the Huns. Attila began in 434 to just sort of harass the area. He really never actually conquered Rome, and he died in 453. The fourth trumpet is Odoacer and the fall of Western Roman Empire when there was no more Caesars after this time, after 476 AD, when Odoacer came in and deposed the Caesar that was there at that time. Then Rome ceased as a political form of government. During this time, darkness in the religious world and political worlds was great. There was no learning, no school learning. There was no advancement in medicine. There was no advancement in any kind of education. There was no advancement in scripture learning. The Bible was taken away from the people. This was a very dark time. That's why it's called the Dark Ages. The fifth trumpet is the rise of Islam. Now, we won't cover that today. We're going to cover the last three trumpets next week. But I'm just wanting to summarize them all here together. The fifth trumpet relates to the first woe. Yes?
On the slide previous to this one, you had 476 AD. That was just a single date.
476 AD was when they captured Rome and deposed the final.
Okay, was that the beginning of the fourth trumpet? And then on the next page, those dates are the fourth trumpet?
No. The fourth trumpet began before this, but the 476 was when they actually conquered. We'll get into it more. This is just a summary. This is not the last time you're going to see this morning. So the sixth trumpet concerns Islam, and we'll get into this next week. I'm not going to try to explain this right now, but these dates are pretty absolute. We know when Islam came into effect. We know how long it lasted in its first push. We have an absolute date for when they worked this push the second time. That's 299. And we know when that second push ended with the absolute fulfillment of the prophecy in 1840 to a specific date, August 15th, 1840. It came to an end. I mean, that's prophecy, and it was absolutely fulfilled. During the time of the sixth trumpet, we have the French Revolution and the close of prophetic time. Then we have the reemergence of Islam and the third woe. Now, I put a date on here, 1988, and I'm not going to explain that until we get to the trumpets. And I'll show you why I think that that's an absolute time for the fulfillment of this trumpet. The seventh trumpet is the second coming of the Lord. It is the final cleansing of the sanctuary. It declares the coronation of the King of Kings, like we saw. So it fits in. These trumpets fit into those types that we saw in the Old Testament. Now, and before AD 325, I've got this date here because that's the time that this council was called. During the early 300s, there became a conflict between the leaders of the church that were Alexandria in Egypt and those that were in Constantinople and Antioch over the nature of the Godhead. Athanasius said that Christ was 100% God. No doubt about that. He was not in any form, any change, any substance, any different than God the Father. Arius said no, that Christ was a little less than God. He defined it as something along the lines of the Gnostic philosophy of you have the great God and then you have the demigod. And that's kind of where Arius came from. Well, there were a lot of people that believed Arius. And there was a great conflict that arose in the church over this subject. It was the first major conflict in the church. So in AD 325, Constantine called a council. In 325, Constantine the Great called a council because he was tired of this argument. He had accepted Christianity in 321, was not baptized at that time. He wasn't baptized till he died, or just before he died. But he called a council to settle this issue. So in 325, they had the first church of the council at Nicaea to discuss how to handle the opinions of Arius regarding the divine nature of Christ. And at that time, it fell that Athanasius was correct and Arius was wrong. And Arius was banished. He wasn't killed, but he was banished from the realm. Constantine said, okay, you're a troublemaker, out of here, and he sent him off into the wilderness. Then in 327, 2 years later, Constantine's sister, who was also named Constantius, I mean, they were very unimaginative in these names. All three of Constantine's sons was Constans, Constantine II, and Constantius. I mean, go figure. Seemed like we should have Bill and John and Sam or something, you know? Constantine's sister was dying in 327, and she begged her brother, Constantine, to recall Arius, because she was an Arian, and she said that she felt that Arius had been abused, that he was misunderstood, and that his view on Christ was wrong. It was misunderstood. Constantine listened to her, and he brought Arius back. Between 327 and 359, there were several councils that were called, arguing about who was right over the nature of the Godhead. This was a major discussion. And two of Constantine's sons were zealous Catholics. The third, the one that got the eastern part, was an Arian. So they bickered among themselves. Finally, in 359, there was only one remaining son, and he was the one that had the western sector. He called another council. Now, he was the Arian. He called another council in 359, and he called every bishop in the empire to come to this council. And this council, I mean, this was fascinating reading. I know I'm probably boring you all, but it was fascinating reading. It really was. Because at this council, there was so much trickery, so much intrigue, so much threat of punishment to try to get everybody to sign this creed that had been developed to accept Arianism. So Constantius, who was the remaining son that had now control of the whole empire was his now, he called this council, and he wanted to be sure that everybody could get there, so he had two parts to the council. One was in Antioch, one was in Italy, so everybody could get there. They couldn't say, well, I can't catch a boat, you know, well, fine, we'll just hold it over there where you are. And then he had emissaries that went back and forth between the two councils. At the end of this council, the ones in Italy were all Athanasians, and they said, we're not going to accept the Arian view. Well, Constantius said, then you'll stay in council until you do. And they were there for months, under guard. They couldn't leave. And, of course, the guard made them terribly miserable. It was cold, and they didn't feed them well, and you know they were living in miserable conditions. And finally, a lot of them did sign, but there were a number that didn't. So Constantius said, no, we're going to have unity here. I want unity. Everybody's going to sign this, that they accept the Arius position, or we don't go home. So the Athanasian bunch said, well, we'll just rework this creed. We'll rewrite it. So they did. They set about rewriting it. And in their wording, they said, Christ was not a creature like other creatures. He was of the same substance as God. Well, when they wrote that, the Arians said, okay, we'll sign that. And then after it was signed, then they said, your wording admits that Christ is a creature because you say he's not a creature like the rest of creatures. He is a created being. So they accepted it. That was signed in 359. And from 359, I mean, the Athanasians were the one that wrote the creed. They just didn't realize what they were doing. They weren't careful in their wording. So from 359, for a number of years, Arianism was the doctrine of the church because it was supported by the emperor. We have absolute union of church and state. And when you have union of church and state, you have persecution. So that at this time, from 359 on, anybody that was not an Arian was persecuted. The Arians went into the churches that were controlled by the Athanasians and tried to take over the churches. The Athanasians says, you're not coming in. They had bloody wars right there in the churches. People were murdered in the churches because they would not let the Arians in. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible time. But we see that when you have church and state united, you lose your liberties, especially religious liberty, and you have persecution. Constantius died in 361. So less than 2 years, actually, after this council in 359 was held, and Arianism took control of the church, the primary promoter died. He was succeeded by his cousin named Julian, and he was a young man, 20-something. He was a thorough pagan, and he had seen all this argument that had gone on between the Athanasians and the Arians, and he said, I'm not having any of this. So he worked to bring the official religion of the empire back to paganism. Of course, this didn't move the Arians or the Athanasians. And they realized, both sides of the church realized that they could not petition the emperor anymore because the emperor wasn't going to listen to them. They didn't settle their argument, but separation of church and state did come and persecution ceased because the Arians couldn't fight against the Athanasians and kill anybody. They would have been persecuted for murder. So when you had a pagan emperor, you had peace in the church. Even if you didn't have theological agreement, there was peace. Because there was the next three emperors, Julius, Jovan, and Valentinian, so the time goes from 361 to 375, there was peace in the church because all three of these were pagan emperors and they chose not to get involved in the arguments in the church. In 380, after Valentinian died, he had two sons, and they were both children. One was 13 and one was 6, so they were obviously not old enough to rule, had many, you know, counselors that were telling them what to do, and they ruled the eastern sector. Theodosius, who was a general, was put in charge of the western sector and ruled from Rome. Because the other two emperors were children, he took the upper hand, and he was a Catholic. In AD 380, he issued an edict declaring that it is our pleasure that the nations which are governed by our clemency and moderation should steadfastly adhere to the religion which was taught by St. Peter to the Romans. We authorize the followers of this doctrine to assume the title of Catholic Christians. And as we judge that all others are extravagant madmen, we brand them with the infamous name of heretics. Now it switched the other direction. If you were an Arian or whatever, you were a heretic. The Catholics now had control. So, I mean, this was just back and forth, back and forth. How can a church that follows Christ suffer and permit this much turmoil within the church? No matter what your doctrines are, it's not following Christ to act this way. Arianism, as a matter of fact, did not get settled for more than 100 years after this. The whole issue continued for more than 100 years after this. The historian Henry H. Milman said, after this edict of Theodosius, he said, "Thus the religion of the whole Roman world was enacted by two feeble boys and a rude Spanish soldier." There were no church councils that came in at this time. Theodosius just stood up on his hind legs and he says, "The whole realm's going to be Catholic. I decree it is." What else was going on during this time? Don't know, right? That's why we're studying our history. What else was going during this time? There were some people who were following the Bible. There were a small number of people who still were Sabbath keepers. There were a small number of people who still lived by the rule of the Bible and the Bible alone. Even though all this argument was going on in the church, there were people who didn't get involved in it. And this man, Ulfilas, was one of them. He was a Christian missionary who worked among the Gothic nations and the tribes on the northern frontiers of the empire. He was born in Asia Minor, what's now Turkey, and he traveled up into those Balkan states and beyond. So he was actually a Christian missionary to these barbarian tribes that we now call the Huns and the Goths and the Ostrogoths and the Alemannes and whatever. And as he worked, he was strongly opposed to the allegorizing of the Bible that the Roman ecclesiastics were doing. Now, allegorizing means that you take the scripture and you just say, well, it doesn't really mean that. And they tell a story about it, and they say, well, you know, if we really get into this, we can see that what's really being said is, and they interpret it their own way. That's allegorizing. And that's what was happening. That's why all these false doctrines were able to come into the church at this time, because they didn't take the reading of the Bible as it was written. They would say, well, what John really meant when he wrote this was, and they'd put their own spin on it. Or what Jesus really meant when he said that was, and they'd put their own spin on it. That's why they came up with Sunday keeping instead of Sabbath keeping. They put their own spin on it. But Ulfilas was a Greek, not meaning that he was from Greece, but that he was Greek speaking. And he was a Seventh-day Sabbath keeper. Interesting, huh? And he taught the fourth commandment to the Gothic nations because he taught the Bible and the Bible alone. This quote here, I want you to note the date because this is the years of this historian from this time. I won't even attempt to say his name. Sidonius Apollinarius. I did attempt it. There you are. Anyway, this historian from the time said, "It is a fact that formerly those who dwelt in the East were accustomed as a church to sanctify the Sabbath," that is, the Seventh-day Sabbath. "It is therefore possible for the Goths who have thought, as pupils of the discipline of the Greeks, that they should sanctify the Sabbath." So when Ulfilas went up there and taught these people the Bible, and taught them biblical truths and taught them the gospel of Jesus Christ, he also taught them Seventh-day Sabbath keeping. Henry Milman said, "There is no trace of Arianism surviving in the remains of the Gothic translation of the New Testament." The Gothic translation of the New Testament? They didn't have a written language when Ulfilas went up there. Ulfilas had to create a written language. Then he created a Bible in that translation, much the same way that Sequoia created a written language for the Cherokee Indians. Living in this part of the country, we ought to know about Sequoia and his creation of a written language for the Cherokees. They were the only ones that had a written language, the only Indians. Ulfilas went in and he phonically wrote down the sounds of their language and created an alphabet from that. And from that, he then translated the Bible that he had into their language and he taught them how to read it. Pretty incredible. He worked for years among these Goths. Once he created a written language for them, then he was able to teach them the Word of God from a written page. And as Milman said, there is not a trace of Arianism surviving in the Gothic translation of the New Testament. So we do have some of these Bibles that were translated by Ulfilas. The Goths were taught to adhere to the words of Scripture delivered to them by Ulfilas, and they call themselves Catholic, not Arians. Because the Athanasian view was the truth. The Arian view was not the truth on the nature of the Godhead and the nature of Christ. So they call themselves Catholic. I'll make a point of this in a minute, so remember this. As a result of the work of Ulfilas, the Goths refused to believe, like the Church of Rome did, on their ecclesiastical points and the things that they brought in, because these pagan things that were brought into the church weren't in the Bible. So the Goths refused them. And as a consequence, later on in history, they were branded as heretics, and the label Arian was used for anybody who didn't believe like the Church of Rome told them to believe, whether they were Arian or not. It was a very handy label. Now, I'm not attempting to make all the Gothic nations to be born-again Christians. They weren't. But they were taught the gospel. Some of them certainly were transformed in the way they lived. They were no longer, you know, had their barbarian attitude towards things. But what I'm trying to present here is a bigger history, because when you read commentaries on the Bible, it says that those tribes that were destroyed were Arian, right? That's why they were destroyed, because they were Arian. History does not support that. They were labeled Arian, but they were not in fact Arian. And that's what we've seen in this history just now. Does that make a difference? Yes, it does. But Ulfilas has left record of his work among the Gothic nations up there, and he has showed us that it was extremely difficult to get them to change from their attitude, their hot temper. He might could teach them the gospel, and they would believe what he said, but when it came right down to it, their tempers controlled them more than the gospel did. This is a quote from Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. The barbarians were easily provoked. They knew not how to forgive an injury, much less an insult. Their resentments were bloody and implacable. The casual disputes that so frequently happened in their tumultuous parties of hunting and drinking were sufficient to inflame the minds of whole nations, and they would go to war against one another and kill one another even though they were brothers. And then they'd say, oh well, you made me mad, so I killed you. That's the way they lived. They thought nothing of chastising the insolent, or plundering the defenseless. That was an opportunity for war. If you insulted me, I'm going to go to war. If you look weak, I'm going to go to war, just because I can. That was their attitude. When these facts are understood, and their aggressive nature and their warlike tendencies were never really conquered, even though they had been exposed to the Bible of Christianity and the work that Ulfilas did among them in translating their Bibles, the vast majority of them were not converted. They continued to behave in their barbarian kind of way. So the Goths, the Heruli, the Vandals, and the Huns would have considered the arrogance of the Roman Church ecclesiastics as arrogance. And they would have seen that by being labeled heretics, because they didn't follow Rome, they would have seen that as cause for attacking Rome. The weakness of the emperors at this time, where one after another fell, or you had children that were in place, they would have seen that as opportunity to overrun the area politically. Why not? You know, let's go down and see what we can take home with us. So now we're going to review the scriptures that we already read, and I'm going to put them in the context of the trumpets, of what we've, this history that we've just learned. So let's reread the scripture. And the seven angels which had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth. And a third part of the trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. Now, Edward Gibbons says that during this time, the pastures of Gaul, in which the flocks and herds grazed, were suddenly changed into a desert, distinguished from the solitude of nature only by smoking ruins. These barbarians, when they got on the move, came through with an earnest. They rode on horseback. They swarmed down out of the mountains. They burned everything that was in their way, burned villages, whole forests, everything. They didn't care. It was slash and burn, just like we did over there in Vietnam. You know, that's how you're going to get the enemy. They're hiding in the woods. You burn the woods. They're hiding in the village. Burn the village. Doesn't matter. That's the way they behaved. Like hail, the barbarians battered at the northern frontiers of the Roman Empire, first in one place and then another. In AD 410, Alaric the Visigoth, Visigoth meaning Western Goths, Ostrogoths are the Eastern Goths. In 410, Alaric the Visigoth conquered the city of Rome, and he died shortly thereafter, like in 6 months. He was dead. He was only 40 years old. But he died. This prompted the superstition that he died because he attacked the city of God. This superstition was used to try to ward off any more barbarian attacks. You know, this man died because he attacked Rome, so don't attack Rome or you're going to die. Didn't work. The second trumpet sounded, and as it were, a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and a third part of the sea became blood, and a third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and a third part of the ships were destroyed. The Vandals worked all through this area, like I said, from 440 to 455. They swarmed. They had been originally in Spain. They got in an argument among their own Spanish people, their own people that had settled in Spain. Like I said, it didn't cause much for them to have an argument one amongst the other. So Genseric loaded up 80,000 people into ships. And he sailed from Spain to northern Africa. And he established himself there in northern Africa, and within 10 years, he had conquered all that area, not really by fighting, but just by assimilation. There were Catholics in that area. During this time period, is Augustine was in Carthage. That was his home. He lived there during this Vandal invasion. But when the Vandals came in, it was really a much better situation, that's if you can imagine that. But under the Romans, you had very class distinction. You had the very wealthy, and everybody else was poor. There was no middle class. All the artisans, people who worked at trades, who ran the shops, they were considered poor, and they were poor because they were under debt to the wealthy. But the wealthy didn't like being wealthy because they were taxed. Nobody wanted to run the government because if you were a senator or if you were in charge of the city, if there was a shortfall in expenses to run the city, you were expected as a leader of the city to fork the money out yourself to pay the bills. So nobody wanted to be in the government. I mean, it was a terrible time to live in Rome during that because government really was non-existent. Even though we had all these emperors and whatnot, the local city government and the local area government just didn't exist. So when the Vandals came in, if you owed a Roman, didn't matter because the Vandals were in charge. If you lost your property, didn't matter. You got it back because the Vandals reestablished all this. So for the people, the common people who were slaves, they were set free. They no longer had to live under the rule of these wealthy people. So it really wasn't a terrible time when these Vandals moved into northern Africa. Things really got better living-wise. So in 10 years, the Vandals established themselves, and they began to work out of northern Africa in ships, and they conquered all those islands, you know, right at the boot of Italy. You have Sicily, and then you've got some other islands that go up on the western side there of Italy in the Mediterranean Sea. They conquered all those islands. Then they began to concentrate on conquering Italy itself. So they were working from the south, while the Ostrogoths were pushing down from the north in Italy. There wasn't any of this struggle and fight taking place on the eastern side of the Mediterranean. It was just Italy that was being concentrated on, because that's where the Catholic Church was being established. God was using these trumpets to try to bring correction to his church that had gone awry. The Vandals conquered all these islands. Then in 339, get my date straight, in 339, the Vandals moved into Italy and began to persecute and try to move into Rome. Now, you know Rome is inland, but there's a river that runs out into the Mediterranean Sea. The Roman fleet was harbored in this mouth of the river. There were 1,300 ships there at this time. The Vandals, under cover of darkness, towed some of their ships loaded with combustibles into the harbor among the Roman fleet, set fire to them, and burned up 1,300 ships in one night. Destroyed the Roman fleet in one night.
This is the Vandals
did this. In A.D. 55, he pushed all the way in to Rome and conquered Rome. He raided, pillaged, captured the city of Rome, carted off Roman citizens as slaves, took them back to northern Africa, and the Vandals maintained all the islands in North Africa and power over these for quite some time. Now, the third angel, Scripture says, and the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp, and it fell upon a third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters and upon the name, and the name of the star was Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became Wormwood, and many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. During the time, like I said, that Genseric, the Vandal, was pushing up from the south, the Goths were pushing down from the north, and one of the main Gothic generals, or tribal leaders, was Attila. Attila just kind of punched here and he punched there and he just kind of played around because he was collecting tribute. He said, I won't come against war if just pay me some money and give me some gold and I'll leave you alone. And he did. He would rather sit around in his tent and get rich than fight war. But if you pushed him, he'd go to war. So in 351, in response to a request from Genseric, he did cross the mountains and storm down into northern Italy, and they were going to meet in Rome. Genseric from the south, Attila from the north. Well, Attila got all the way to the city of Rome and then backed off. Attila got to Italy ahead of Genseric, but he made a peace treaty with Pope Leo I, and he didn't actually enter the city. It's said that Attila is called the Scourge of God. That's a label that was put on him by a Christian hermit who met him as he was rumbling down through the northern parts of Italy. He came out and he said, "Thou art the Scourge of God, sent to chastise the Christian church." Attila took that title. He liked it. He knew who the Christians were. So he called himself the Scourge of God. The blazing meteor metaphor works because he came down out of the north very quickly on horseback. It said that they rode one and pulled three horses. They lived on horses. All the treaties that they ever made was on horses. Everything they did was on horses. So these two tribes working north and south brought Italy, or the western half of the Roman Empire, to its knees. Attila died in 453, not having conquered much of anything. I mean, he pillaged and burned and did everything else, but he didn't actually conquer Rome. Attila the Hun began his harassment of the eastern section of the Roman Empire before Genseric reached Rome. Both were invading parts of Rome during the same time periods of history, one of them from the south, the other from the north. Genseric's final march on Rome occurred in A.D. 55, but Attila died 2 years before that in 453. The prophecies must be evaluated more by how the symbols apply than by strictly adhering to the dates, because some of the books I looked at said that Attila was the second trumpet and Genseric the third. Others said, no, Genseric was the second, and Attila was the third. So I scratched my head and I said, how do they come to these conclusions? Well, we need to look at the prophecies and see how the symbolism of the prophecies fit the actual historical events. What did Genseric do? The prophecy says, a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea. This reflects his burning of 1,300 ships in one night, doesn't it? A third part of the ships were destroyed, is what the prophecy says. That reflects the fact that a third part, because remember we said that Rome, the empire, was divided up into three pieces? The third part, that western part, lost its whole fleet. So a third part of the ships were destroyed, literally. Genseric captured the major islands of the western section of empire. He brought down that whole western section. So a third part of the sea became blood. We define sea by the Bible. Seas and waters by the Bible means peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. By the time Attila and Genseric got through with their campaigns going through the country of Italy, there was not much left. They destroyed most of the people, burned the villages, forests were gone, farmland was destroyed. There really wasn't anything left. It was unlike anything that had ever been done before. Attila, on the other hand, blazed swiftly. He didn't ride in boats. He came on horseback. He rode over the frozen mountains in the north of Italy like a meteor. He just kind of, pew, here he came, you know. The major rivers of northern Italy all have their headwaters in these same mountains. So the prophecy fits when we talk about the symbolism of rivers and waters. That fits because that's where Attila came from. The judgment was bitter because the consequences were bitter. By the time Attila and the Vandals got through with their pillaging and war in this area, there wasn't much left. It was a bitter consequence that was left on Rome. So the symbolism fits Attila here more than it does Genseric. Now, the fourth angel sounded, and a third part of the sun was smitten, and a third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars, so as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. What did we say about the third parts? The Roman Empire was divided into three parts. This third part, Italy, and that sector, the western sector of Rome, was struck heavy blows by these first four trumpets. The symbolism here deals with the government being the sun, because the Roman emperor was considered the sun of the empire, the S-U-N of the empire. Those that supported him were the moon and the stars. The council, the senate, they all revolved around what the emperor did. And like we said earlier, in 476, the last Western emperor was dethroned by the Heruli under Odoacer. The man's name, and he was just a young man, was Romulus Augustulus. He was the last Roman emperor that actually was seated in Rome. The Heruli put a ruler in place, but he was not a Roman ruler. He was one of their own. Interestingly enough, this last emperor was called Romulus. Do any of you know from your history studies the names of the first two men that established Rome in 700 and something B.C.? Romulus and Remus. Same name. They were brothers. So we have a Romulus that started Rome, and we have a Romulus that was the end of Rome. Bookends. I just found that just terribly interesting that they had the same names. Probably has nothing to do with anything, but I just thought it was terribly interesting. This is our summary. We're about done, so take a few more minutes and we'll be through here. The prophecy in Daniel spoke of a metal man. Daniel chapter 2. Head of gold, chest of silver, belly of brass, two legs of iron, and the feet that were divided into 10 toes that were clay and iron, mixed, right? The two legs represent two halves of Rome. The feet and clay represent divisions of the Roman Empire. This is a standard understanding of the prophecy. So what we see, we're down now into the toes of this prophecy. That's where we are in history. The first four trumpets deal with the breakup of the Roman Empire into the toes. Okay? The western sector stayed under an emperor that still called himself a Roman emperor. I mean, the eastern sector. The western sector stayed under the control of some barbarian ruler for a period of time. But during this time, papal Rome, the church, was rising up, and they were striking to be rid of these barbarians. They were left without control of the eastern half of the armies. They were left to themselves. They formed allegiances with any barbarian tribe that they could. And you remember that 408 is a date that we mark in prophecy, because 408 was when the Pope of Rome formed an allegiance with the Franks, and they became Catholic. And then the Franks began to fight against the other tribes. Okay? 508, not 408. So from 476 until 508, we had this time period that Rome was literally controlled by the barbarians. They set up their own king there in Rome. In 508, the Pope said, no, we're going to do something different, and he formed an allegiance with Clovis, who was a Frank, and then began the battering of the ten horns. So we had 10 divisions, but 3 of them were lost. That's what the prophecy there in Daniel says. The prophecy of Daniel's 10 horns was that the 3 would be replaced by a little horn that came up among the 10. Remember this? That's Daniel 7, 24, and 25. By AD 538, the papal wars had wiped out the 3 rival tribes. The rival tribes being the Vandals, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths. Now remember earlier we said that they were labeled heretics and labeled Arians in the history books. The victor writes the history, right? Whoever wins writes the history. The Roman Catholic Church won. They wrote the history. But that doesn't mean that they're not historians in other parts of the world that were also writing history. So if you just read the Roman Catholic version of the history, these people were called Arian. You read somebody else's version of the history, like we looked at earlier and saw what Ulfilas did, and read a different history from a different perspective, we see that they weren't necessarily Arians. Were they heretics? Well, they didn't go along with the Roman Catholic doctrines, so Rome considered them heretics. To summarize here, from our earlier studies of 2 Thessalonians 2, we learned that Paul said that there would be a falling away and that this man of sin was going to be established. Remember that? But there was something that was hindering the establishment of this man of sin and power. What was hindering was pagan Rome. Once pagan Rome was taken out of the way, then papal Rome could come in. And that's what we've studied here this morning, is these first four trumpets hammered away at pagan Rome until pagan Rome ceased to exist in the Western Empire. Papal Rome filled the void for power. Somebody had to be in charge. Papal Rome rose in place of that. When they rose, they knocked out those 3 tribes that God had used to chastise the church and try to bring it into line. So we'll study more about this when we get to the little horn over there in chapter 13. To put this back in context of the Old Testament, up to the time of the Babylonian exile, monotheism had waged a losing battle against idolatry, and ignorance of the Bible was commonplace. Now we find the same thing in the Christian church. Paganism won. Christianity, true Christianity, waged a losing battle, except in little places like with the Waldensians and the Albigenses. You know, they maintained true Christian worship. But papalism took over and brought in all this paganism, brought in all this idolatry, and this idolatrous methods of worship was all brought into the church. The trumpets were sent by God in an attempt to stop this. Didn't work. Because compromise was made because certain bishops thought that it was beneficial to compromise. If they compromised, criticism was less. If they compromised, they could make more converts. So they saw it as a good thing to compromise on truth. Don't we see that today? If we want to do evangelism, just water down what you've got to say. And then people will believe you because you're not stepping on their toes quite so hard. If you want people to attend church and fill up these empty seats, then do things that they like. Bring in loud music. Bring in song and dance up on the stage. And whatever it takes to bring people into the church, we can do that because at least then they're sitting in the pews. We win that way, right? Well, paganism wins, but God doesn't win. So at this time, Christians were pronounced atheists because they were destitute of temples and altars and victims and priests and all the pomp in which the vulgar pagans supposed the essence of religion to consist. So because the Christians met in homes or in small little meeting places, they didn't have a temple that they went to, they no longer offered sacrifices, they were considered atheists. What? Doesn't your God want blood sacrifice anymore? And they said, no, the blood sacrifice has already been offered. It's Jesus Christ. This onus was put on the Christian church. So in order to get rid of being labeled in a bad way, they thought, well, what's the problem with having a temple? I mean, you know, why not? They adopted pagan temples. The idols that were sitting in the pagan temple, they said, well, we'll just call that one Peter, and we'll call this one Mary, and we'll call that one John. It doesn't have to be any of the pagan names that were on there. We'll just change the name. And they did. The next statement is from Mosheim, who has written quite an extensive ecclesiastical history of the church. And he said, it is certain, well, actually both these quotes are from Mosheim. It is certain that to religious worship, both public and private, many rites were added without necessity and to the offense of sober and good men. Now, sober here means without excessive extremes. It doesn't mean that they're not drunk. It means that they weren't drunk with the wine of Roman Babylon. Here in the New Testament, we find once again that the church is brought under the control of Babylon. And we see that title in chapter 18, don't we? On this Roman church is labeled Mystery, Babylon, the mother of harlots. Actually, that's Revelation 17:5. Ignorance of the Bible was commonplace during the reign of the papal church. From 538 to 1798, for 1260 years, the church was kept away from the people. When the Protestant Reformation came along, they tried to bring the people back to the church. They tried to bring the church into line with true biblical thinking. But like we said earlier, when those original Protestant reformers died, the churches, instead of moving on in their study of the Bible, they developed creeds and went right back to the Roman way of doing things. All this apostasy did not happen without God sending warning after warning after warning. That's what the trumpets were, warnings against what the church was doing. When we get into the next three, actually it's just the two because the seventh trumpet is the second coming of Christ. But when we get into those, we'll see that even the work of Islam was a work of calling to repentance. Final summary. Trumpets were used to announce the coming of the Day of Atonement. The seventh trumpet will sound when the Day of Atonement is complete on this earth. Declare the Day of Jubilee and freedom. That will be a time of freedom for all humans, everyone on this earth, because when that final trumpet sounds, everything that Adam did will be undone. He sold humanity into slavery to Satan. He gave up his dominion over this earth. All that will be restored. The culmination of all events of the great war between Christ and Satan will take place at the sounding of that seventh trumpet. It will also be the coronation of Christ as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. This is a summary. I have a handout that I'll give to you. And of course it'll cover the last three trumpets that we're going to take into consideration next week. And for those that are interested, this is a partial list of my bibliography in this study.